Let me maybe start by giving a couple of arguments against farming, maybe three arguments. Before you comment, let me give me a chance to give some arguments against Barbara. So one argument, which I don't know if it's the correct attribution, but I'm going to attribute to Carlo Rovelli, is that this is not the right way to do quantum cosmology with solutions of the Wheeler-DeWitt equation. And we discussed earlier the Dirac program. And so Carlo Rovelli, or some mythical construction of him that I'm making, would say, Julian, your interpretational postulates are very unstandard. The standard thing we talked about, which is that there's a Hilbert space, which is called the physical Hilbert space, of solutions to the Wheeler-DeWitt equation and other constraints. This equation is defined in some kinematical Hilbert space, if you remember. There's an algebra, a physical, of operators that live in this, or act on this physical Hilbert space, that are Hermitian with respect to its inner product. And that observables consist of objects like the expectation value of some operator corresponding to an observable in a state with a norm that comes from knowing what the correct inner product is. And that when you analyze, and that these observables commute with the Hamiltonian constraint. And I'm really using the same symbol for three different things. So let me use a Rager H for the Hamiltonian constraint there. The observables commute with the Hamiltonian constraint in the kinematical Hilbert space. So they live just on the space of solutions of the Hamiltonian constraint. And Carlo would argue that in the observables, you have all the information that's in classical general relativity, because many of these observables are quantum operators that correspond to classical observables in general relativity. And classical observables in general relativity know about the causal structure, that is, they measure the causal structure. So that these operators will come from classical observables, which classically commute with the Hamiltonian constraint, so that their functions on the constraint surface. And these will be observables, so they're quantizations of observables of classical general relativity. And as we argued before, observables of classical general relativity measure causal structure. As I argued at some length earlier. So that if you really treat this, Carlo would say, as an honest quantum mechanical system with a Hilbert space and an algebra of operators which are its observables, whose classical limit are functions on phase space which are observables of the classical theory, then you can recover from your quantum measurements information about the causal structure, because there are classical observables that say, I'm looking for two events. One event has one list of properties, another event has another list of properties, local properties, like what's the value of various fields there, And then you can ask the question, is the first event in the causal future of the second event? And you can construct a function on phase space that asks that question. Then you can construct a quantum mechanical operator that asks that question. And its expectation value in a state is the probability that in that state there are events with those properties which are causally related to each other, or something like that. So that time as causal structure is not in the state, but it's in the operator algebra that gives us the observables of the theory. So that's the nature of the objection. That is, as Carlo has argued in many papers, and for example, Bianca Dietrich here has investigated, you can construct operators, you can construct observables in the classical theory that measure causal structure, and in a quantization of general relativity, there will be operators that do the same. And that therefore, this idea that the measurement theory, that the square of the wave function corresponds to some number of, you know, configurations is a non-standard approach to quantum mechanics. Yeah.
Sets of G, and you're talking about equivalence classes.
Under different morphisms.
Yes. Surely, the argument isn't just that it's non-standard. It must also say, well, the standard approach is better, right?
I think that a rebellious point of view is that our job is to take quantum mechanics, which is well developed and well understood as to what its physical content is, and general relativity, which is well developed and well understood, both of which are experimentally well tested, and combine them in the most parsimonious way possible. And that may not be the way the world is, but that's the first thing that one should try to do. Now, you know, one can say, as I did at the time, against Rebellion's point of view, that constructing operators that have this property in the language of a real quantum field theory, whether it's loop quantum gravity or string theory or anything else, is a hard computational problem in the class of the hard problems we're talking about. And it may be that this is not realizable in practice, or difficult to realize. Anyway, I just want to set out what the discussions are in the literature. Okay. A very different kind of criticism. Well, before I go to that one, I'll save that one for last. Another criticism is the one that Jonathan mentioned here. And this is, so we can attribute it to you, okay, is that semi-classical states are not typical. Are measured zero. Are very untypical because you can just add, you know, arbitrary superpositions of other semi-classical states, and then you have a state that is no longer semi-classical. And then there's a discussion about that, which I'm not going to go into, but I'm just raising possible objections.
How you singled out one particular classical solution in the first place. Like, why is the world, why do we perceive the particular world that we do, the string of events, rather than some other semi-classical history?
Right, so a thing that I was careful not to say, so I said that classical space-time emerged in the same sense that trajectories emerge in quantum mechanics. And let me get away with that, and you of all people should not have let me get away with that, okay? Because the way that we do it in particle mechanics, the way that we go from this picture to focus on a particular classical solution is we construct wave packets. But we construct a wave packet which is peaked, which is highly peaked around some initial configuration, and then it stays sort of highly peaked over a trajectory. And the problem with constructing wave packets is that that requires superposing solutions of different energy. But again, as you should know better than anybody, the whole point is that these are solutions of the Wheeler-DeWitt equation, and they're all energy equals zero solutions. And you can do a lot, you can still try to superpose some other things, but there are no conserved quantities in the configuration space of general relativity analogous to momentum or angular momentum that you can try to use to build up wave packets and make things localized in configuration space. And that's an issue. That's an issue. And now, Barber addresses this issue, and I would just, rather than my going into a discussion and rest on some technical issues, let me just refer anybody who's interested to Barber's books and papers, because this issue is addressed. Okay. How successfully, I would leave it to you to judge. Okay. There's a third objection, which is I've never heard of discussed in this context, but I think it can be, and it's the so-called Boltzmann brain problem. And so I'm going to I'll attribute it to Boltzmann or B. And this is an issue that arises in different versions of quantum cosmology, but I think, and you'll see how convinced you are of this, it arises here. And this is just the observation that there are going to be all that's required for this psychophysical parallelism is that there are in the big configuration, which is given by a point in the configuration space, a big universe that somewhere there's a bunch of things organized like a brain. So you can make the observation that there are going to be many configurations that look like total chaos in a big universe, total unclassical chaos. And then somewhere is a little bunch of stuff which is like a brain. Whatever it means to be like a brain, be have sufficient complexity. Maybe it even means you're made of proteins and, you know, nucleic acids and whatever. But whatever being a brain means, there are, because brains are very small compared to the infinite size that a universe can be, there are going to be lots and lots of configurations that don't look anything like slices of a nice, smooth, classical universe in which just somewhere there's a brain. Okay? And by Julian's postulate three, that brain is having an experience of whatever its state, which might be seeing a green wall in front of it. Then there's an argument, which I have not sat down and made, and so nobody has sat down and made it, because I don't know if anybody has applied this to Barber's thing, but now there's an argument in which you would argue something like that, like the following. Given almost any wave function, okay, it may be that you have a wave function where the statistical weight, that is what this gives on, or, so such things are called Boltzmann brains. The brains that are there basically by a statistical or a quantum fluctuation, they ought not to be there. They're very unlikely to be there. Just all of a sudden, you know, a brain springs. If were there time so things were happening, all of a sudden there would be a weird statistical fluctuation in the motion of atoms, and there's a brain. And in a universe which is just the infinite dimensional, infinite volume configuration space of all the possible configurations, there's going to be a lot of those. And now you have to do a counting problem, which I haven't done. I'll tell you about an analogous counting problem, which a number of people have done, in which you say, even if I choose a nice semi-classical wave function like this, there are going to be a certain amount of brain in the classical trajectory that that picks out. Assume even I can make a wave packet. Okay? So there's a classical trajectory that gets picked out. And in that classical trajectory of the universe, there's a certain number of planets, and a certain number of those planets have brains on them, and there's a certain number of brains. But in the same quantum collection of universes, there's going to be a large number of very improbable brains that exist off in the tails of the wave functions. So this, they represent a configuration space that is not remotely classical, that has no classical history that it's a part of. So it's not going to by itself be very probable in the square of the wave function, measured by the square of the wave function. But there's going to be a lot of them. How many? Well, just think about, you know, multiply a very small number, which is the probability that there just be a statistical fluctuation in a region of space-time that makes a brain. That's a very small number, but there's a huge volume. In every point of configuration space is a typically huge or infinite volume universe. And then there's an infinite number of those points of configuration space. So you multiply a very small number by a very big number. And it's plausible, again, I haven't done the calculation, that a typical brain, that is a typical conscious experience, according to these rules, is not a conscious experience of a person who is the result of biological evolution on a planet in a universe which is nice and classical. Okay? But a typical conscious experience will be a conscious experience of a brain that just happens to exist as a fluctuation in a very unclassical region of configuration space. Okay.
Are we restricted by the fact that classical universes tend to have, you know, a smaller number of brains compared to universes that are highly random that could have unconsciously infinitely many brains?
Yeah,
they don't have to resemble classical physics. You can just...
They don't have to resemble classical physics. They don't have to be the result of
just all
billions of years of biological evolution. They just have to be the result of a, you know, of a unlimited configuration. Yes.
The comment that I was like this comment, I mean, because up here you said that, I mean, the probable, most probable trajectory is that trajectory that happened like classically. But it means that, so the least probable one, at least you had to show one example of that, like what you said, that there's another thing that is not exactly that classical. But we don't have like that.
Well, all this is hand waving, but yeah, the point is well taken. Let me just take you two guys, and I'll say a calculation which is not difficult to do, which I'll sketch and leave it to you for homework. So yes.
Well, Don Page, for example, argues that for a closed universe, even in the regular picture, by making a Boltzmann's brains argument. But doesn't Barbour's picture allow us flexibility in choosing the actions so that we can actually suppress those rogue brains to whatever degree we please?
Maybe.
So wouldn't that comment actually, I mean, if you took this stuff seriously, which you may, wouldn't that comment actually support Barbour's hypothesis?
Well, so let me make the argument that Don Page and, what's his name, Ben Freiman, who is visiting right now, and people like that, Rafael Busso, who we were talking before about in another context. Let me make the argument that they make. Okay. They make the argument of supposing that the cosmological constant is positive, even slightly positive. Then any universe, no matter what it is, sooner or later goes into a de Sitter phase. That is, it cools to the point. So there's a de Sitter temperature analogous to the Unruh temperature in any universe that has a positive cosmological constant. And this de Sitter temperature Oh boy, look. In some units, it's the square, somebody knows the square root of the cosmological constant in some units. Yes, okay. And so any universe, including our own, because as far as we know, there is evidence for a positive cosmological constant, if that's really a cosmological constant, not some other form of dark energy, will cool, that is, all the stars, all the galaxies will cool till the whole universe is in thermal equilibrium at this temperature. And this is a very small temperature, but the universe will be in approximate thermal equilibrium at that temperature for an infinite time into the future. So exactly the scenario of Boltzmann's heat death of the universe is, if the cosmological constant is real, is a real thing, is the fate of this universe. And in this universe, it's also expanding the volume as a function of some time, some standard cosmological time, goes like exponential of that time. So almost all of space, you know, infinitely, there's infinitely more space-time to the future of when space-time reaches thermal equilibrium at the De Sitter temperature than there is before it. Okay? And in each fixed volume of space-time in that thermal equilibrium is a probability to make a Boltzmann brain, which is, you know, proportional to the volume. It's exponentially suppressed by a huge number over the temperature, but it doesn't matter because the volume is infinite. So the argument goes, and this is really the thermal heat death of the universe. The argument goes that there will, before the universe reaches thermal equilibrium, there will have been some number of planets that had life, and there will have been some finite number of species that were alive and had brains and were the result of biological evolution. But there will be an infinity of brains that exist momentarily as fluctuations in thermal equilibrium in the infinitely long era of the universe where it comes to thermal equilibrium. So therefore, almost every conscious experience in our universe, under these assumptions, is going to be the experience of a brain which exists momentarily as a thermal fluctuation. And therefore, since that is not our experience, one of two things is true. Either the cosmological scenario is false, for one of several reasons, or the assumption made here of relating experience to brains in that naive way is false. That is, I used an argument that we should be typical experiencers, and we're experiencing beings should have typical experiences in the universe, and the most typical experience is one of momentary shock, because you just, it's like you're in a drastic form of the situation of that, what's his name, the great brain scientist who's such a good writer writes about, the guy in New York.
What's his name?
Anyway, he writes for the New Yorker often. You know who he is.
Oliver Sacks.
Oliver Sacks, yeah. Thank you. Yeah, so Oliver Sacks writes about, you know, a few very unfortunate people who lose the ability to form memories, and each moment, and there are people like this, there fortunately aren't many, each moment is a new awakening, is a surprise. And they keep diaries, and the diaries are like, oh my God, I'm awake. What just happened? You know, their diaries are always expressions of surprise, and they have some memories which make them able to function, which they keep with them, but they
they're continually in a state of surprise. And then there's some marvelous things that some of them can sit down and play music and be appear relatively normal for the period they're playing a piece of music, et cetera. But anyway, that's a sideshow. So some people take this argument seriously, and in the context of anthropic approaches to cosmology, it's an argument which is taken seriously and discussed. I'll point out that it's even worse if you happen to believe in eternal inflation, because if you happen to believe in eternal inflation, then it's not just the future of our universe, but our universe is a relatively cool pocket in an infinite extent of eternally inflating vacuum, which is at a very high temperature. And the argument can be applied even more forcefully to the possibility of experience by brains that come to exist in the multiverse, which is eternally large and eternally present, et cetera.
So it seems to me making a distinction between our brains and these momentary shock brains that occur.
Well, the argument is the innate quantum theory of cosmology. Okay, what should be the
probability measure that we use to deduce from the quantum state of the universe what's a probable observation for an observer to make? And given that an observer is a subsystem of the universe, you have to. If your quantum cosmology is based on something like solutions of the Wheeler-DeWitt equation, you have to address the question of how do you deduce probabilities for different observers. And if your algorithm is look for configurations which are brain-like and compute their probability for what they would be observing, and try to extract from that the cosmological parameters, which is an algorithm that people have tried to do, a number of attempts of that form at giving a measurement theory for quantum cosmology have run into very serious difficulties because of the observation, which I think is originally by Don Page, that these disembodied momentary brains would be much more likely in most contemporary versions of cosmology than brains of beings like ourselves as a result of biological evolution. Now, at this point, one can understandably become very impatient with the discussion and think there's something wrong, because scientists should not be making angels on the head of a thin argument like how many conscious experiences are there in the universe given by a certain wave function of the universe. But what this points out, the persistence of this argument by smart people, points out, in my view, points out the likely falseness of the whole approach to physics based on the wave function of the universe living in a Hilbert space, et cetera. But it's not an easy argument if you accept the premises of the argument, which many working cosmologists do. After all, it is the Wheeler-DeWitt equation, which is it's just the Schrodinger equation with the d by dt term pointed across. There's a lot of reasons you might try to believe it. If you believe it, then it's hard to get out of this argument. And you can study the recent literature and see, to what extent you believe that people have successfully gotten at it.
With the Wheeler-DeWitt equation analog and loop quantum gravity, then?
I don't think so.
Even if there are an infinite number of Wolfram brains in the universe, we are forced to accept nothing more than the fact that we're atypical observers. And we can't even talk about some concept like the probability of us being us is zero, because probability isn't defined for a sample space like that. I think we're forced to accept nothing more than we're not typical.
Good.
So we're not bugs either. Bugs don't ask these questions. We are the physicists who ask these questions.
Right. So let me tell you, so the question is, okay, how radical surgery is needed on the standard view. Now, you may be able to make that work. Okay. So
let me support you a little bit, okay? There's a lot of cases, and there's a philosophical literature about this. There's a lot of cases where the arguments in typicality fail. There are a lot of cases where it's useful to make an argument from typicality. You know, for better or worse, I mean, life insurance companies really make money. Okay? And there are many instances in which arguments from typicality do apply to conscious experience in human beings and so forth. But there are clearly some fallacies inherent in misuse of the arguments from typicality. So let me give you an example. Let me assume that I am a typical human being. Okay. This is an argument that was made, to my knowledge, from the first time by Holger Nielsen, although it's usually attributed to other people. And so Holger begins, I am a typical human being. If I am typical, I must be typical in every interesting respect, because otherwise I wouldn't be typical. So here is a respect in which I must be typical. There is a population of all the human beings who will ever live. And in the population of all the human beings who will ever live, there's an ordering according to birthday. And if I'm typical, I should be typical with respect to that ordering, which means that I should not be one of the really early ones. I should not have, you know, I should not be one part in a thousand among the early human beings, and I should not be one of the later ones. I should be in the middle. And then you look at the curve of population. It's been growing exponentially for many thousands of years, which means that in any era, including our era, a surprisingly large proportion of all the human beings who ever lived are alive now. I think it's something like, I forget if it's 5% or 20% or something. I forget if it's 1 in 5 or 1 in 20, but it's something like that. Does anybody know? Anyway, it's probably not specifiable to that precisely anyway. But it's not, you know, 1 in a million of human beings who ever lived are alive now. It's something like 1 out of 5, 1 out of 10. Therefore, the population is growing exponentially. Therefore, there are three possible future fates. If it keeps growing exponentially, then I will turn out to have been one of the early ones. And we said that then I would not be typical. If it even levels out the way that the UN likes to project, okay, after a few hundred years, I will be very much among the early ones. If it levels out at 8 billion people or 6 billion or 10 billion or whatever. Okay, after long enough, we, all of us in this early phase, will have, exponential phase, will have been early. So the only way I can continue, the only way I can be a typical human being is if the population within my lifetime begins to decline exponentially. Therefore, purely from the assumption that I'm a typical human being, there is a catastrophe that will happen to the human population within our lifetime, and it will start to decline exponentially, and decline exponentially for quite a long time after that. Yeah.
Reject the assumption that part of typicality is, or that it's, well, part of typicality is living in the middle. I mean, once I know this function, that it grows exponentially, I would say part of typicality is live rather late.
It's very interesting to identify the fallacy of this argument. And let me mention, by the way, this is called the doomsday argument. And there is a literature about this among physicists and cosmologists. For example, it was published in Nature by somebody who was not Holger Nielsen, but invented it a few years after,
who is Richard Gott at Princeton, the astronomy department at Princeton. There's also a book about it. by a recently retired professor of philosophy at Guelph, whose name is evading me, but somebody who's noted as a philosopher of science at Guelph. There is a philosophical literature about it. Notice that if I still have it here, if I adopt the reality of the succession of present moments, then I can simply deny the argument, because I can deny the reality or the existence of any ensemble of the form of all human beings will ever live. That is, if I insist that everything that is real or is true or is property that can have a truth value is something which is real at a given moment, then the ensemble of all human beings who will ever live is just simply not something that we can reason logically about. We can talk about this going to be, you know, by the end of humanity or the end of time or whatever, there will have been some ensemble of human beings who ever live. But if I really want an implication of this hypothesis is that at a present moment you can't reason logically. There isn't anything that can have a property, there isn't any property that can have a truth value consisting of all the human beings who will ever live. And that's actually my point of view. You know, the way that I would get out of this and the Boltzmann brains arguments and a whole lot of other arguments that are used in cosmology these days is to adhere to this hypothesis. It's a kind of acid. That's one reason why I like it. I mean, this form of, this is not quite what philosophers always call presentism, but it's a form of presentism. Everything that is real or true is real or true in a moment, which is one of the succession of moments. It's a very acidic proposition. It disables and cuts out a lot of other reasoning. And I actually think that's a good thing. Yeah.
Are you to saying that you can't reason about the evolution of physical systems?
No. No, it's there are some things that we can reason about, and there are some things we can't reason about. That is, roughly speaking, you know, a property, it doesn't mean you can't make predictions and put probabilities on predictions and so forth, but it means that, you know, say, you know, when this computer will turn off for the last time is something which
it will be true. This little computer will have a last moment of sight. It will have a last CPU cycle. Okay. When it will be is, and what it will be, the content of that last CPU cycle is not, I would claim, something which is real at the present moment. It was the property of another present moment. We can reason in this present moment about it. We can say most likely it will be within 10 years. Most likely it will not be, you know, working for the National Security Agency, decoding a message from somebody. You know, there are various things you can say are probably true about the last CPU cycle of the computer, but I don't need to believe that that there are any present truth values. This is going in a different direction, but let me go here. What this implies is that propositions that have truth values are time bound. Propositions that have truth values at a moment or in a moment of time. And there are many propositions you can make about the future that have no truth values present. And I not only don't see anything wrong with that, I suspect that we do live in a universe like that. One of the reasons I suspect we live in a universe like that is the argument that I was making about biology from Stu Kaufman, But I suspect that that argument is much stronger, has a much stronger range of validity than biology, but it's sufficient applied to biology. Because biology is part of the universe, biology is part of the physical universe. And I don't see why I should believe. I'm able to make lots of propositions about the life, you know, the biosphere of the Earth in a billion years, but I don't see why any of them should have truth values at the present time.
What about
the past?
Well, according to this, the past has the same status as the future, but we live in a world where the past does have a different status than the future. At least there are lots of fossils around. So there are lots of things in the present world that allow us to deduce things that were probably true in past moments. And because the world is not in thermodynamic equilibrium, there is a strong asymmetry. We happen to live in a universe with a strong asymmetry between how much about the past can be deduced from present data versus how much of the future can be deduced from present data. But I think I'm committed to saying that logically they're on the same basis. But I don't think these are easy questions. The reason for the asymmetry is that we're very far from thermal equilibrium.
Why are we very far from thermal equilibrium?
I mean, that's a question I thought a lot about. It is the right question to ask, because 14 billion years after both the Big Bang is a long time for the universe to come from thermal equilibrium. You know, this is like being a little kid in the chain of whys. I'll tell you why, and then you'll say why that, and why, you know, why that. The universe is far from thermal equilibrium because gravity has two properties. One of them is it's far weaker than the other forces, and the other one is that it's universally attractive. And that means that on large scales, the universe is dominated by gravitationally bound systems, and gravitationally bound systems do not, because they have negative specific heat, because the gravitational force is long range and attractive, they are not describable by canonical partition functions, so they're not describable by standard thermodynamics. And a consequence of that is plus some facts about nuclear physics is stars. So the fact is that the universe, big regions of the universe, relatively sizable, I mean, regions of the universe are out of thermal equilibrium because there are very hot stars in a cold background. And those hot stars persist, their formation persists as processes, and they themselves persist on time scales of billions of years, which is, say, comparable to the present Hubble time, the lifetime of stars, and the lifetime of star-forming processes, that is, disk galaxies, the time parameter over which disk galaxies slowly relax and cease to form stars is comparable to the Hubble time. And those are some remarkable features of our world. And if you ask, why are those things true? It comes down to why are the parameters of the standard model what they are. And if you ask, why are they what they are, then you reach one of, for me, one of the strongest arguments, and I only have 15 minutes to summarize it, so I'm happy to go there. For me, what's one of the strongest arguments to believe in the non-emergence of time, which is that the only so Peirce, the American philosopher Charles Sanders Peirce, discussed this issue in the 1890s. And he gives a beautiful quote. I'm not going to bother to turn the computer on and project it to you, but maybe I'll just turn it on for myself and read the quote if I can find it. If my computer doesn't completely glitch out. Oh, it's glitching out because it's looking for a thing that's not there. Okay, let's see if this is going to just go insane or if there's a chance. You're not seeing any of this, right? No, let me just find this. Okay. So Charles Sanders Peirce said in 1893, to suppose universal laws of nature capable of being apprehended by the mind and yet having no reason for their special form, but standing inexplicable and irrational is hardly a justifiable position. Uniformities are precisely the sort of facts that needs to be accounted for. Law is par excellence the thing that wants a reason. The parameters of the standard model of particle physics have to have somehow a rational explanation that has falsifiable consequences. That's my little insertion. Now, the only possible way of accounting for the laws of nature and for uniformity in general is to suppose the results of evolution, by which the context shows he meant evolution by natural selection. So to telescope a lot of discussion, this is the forefront issue in particle physics these days. The attempts to explain why the parameters of the standard model are the way they are, one research program in our lifetime failed, which is the hypothesis that there would be a unique unification which implied unique values for the parameters of the standard model of particle physics. And I think it's by now pretty much conceded that whether string theory is right or not, that's the fate of the string theory project as far as predictions are concerned. One can, of course, appeal to God, or God made the universe in order that we would be here, et cetera. One can imagine that there are vast populations of random universes with random laws. And those, however, make no predictions. Those approaches to the multiverse make no predictions. And I'm very happy on another occasion if people want to argue that in great depth, because I've thought about it and argued it in great depth. But particularly, they haven't made any predictions, not a one. Possibly that the curvature of the universe should be either positive or negative, I don't remember. But that's also debatable. And you know, Lenny Susskind is in the building, and you know, if anybody's interested in this, you should talk with Lenny about these things. He's tried harder than anybody else in recent years to get science out of this situation. I think he would concede that they've not succeeded so far, nor has anybody else. So the last possibility is the possibility that Peirce anticipated. Of course, philosophers are smarter than physicists, and not surprising that a philosopher had thought this over and anticipated the whole story. And the interesting thing is that if you want to follow Peirce's advice, you need a theory of the past history of the universe in which time exists. That is, if you want to now start to tell a story of the evolution of laws leading to the parameters of the standard model as analogous to natural selection, you have, and again, I can make a detailed argument to this effect, you have to do it in the context in which there is a meaningful global time parameter in which it makes sense to talk about increasing fitness of regions of space and time, and so forth. That is, you know, ensembles that evolve according to the mathematics of natural selection are out of equilibrium, they're highly non-random, and they're highly time-dependent. And you therefore need to realize Peirce's advice a notion of time which transcends the Big Bang and transcends both the, you know, the beginning of our region of space-time, and even transcends the notion of a static law. That is, notice what's happening in Barbara's kind of thing. The law is eternal. Time is emergent. Therefore, fundamentally, there is a law of nature which is just there timelessly. Its domain is timeless. That is, in the sense of the domain of its rules is timeless. The world it describes is fundamentally timeless, and time, in limited senses, is emergent in limited domains and limited senses. And in such a context, you can't realize Peirce's advice and imagine the universe to be evolving in a sense in which some quantity analogous to fitness is increasing. If you want to follow Peirce's advice, then time not only has to be not emergent in a particular physical theory, it has to outlast the domain of any particular physical theory. So you have to imagine a succession of physical theories existing in limiting domains of time, which means that time is so non-emergent that that it exists, its existence supersedes the domain of different laws. And that possibility, which is quite striking, is the one that I think we're led to if we want to have a rational explanation that is one that's checkable by falsifiable predictions of why the parameters of the standard model are why they are, and therefore why the universe is out of thermal equilibrium. To cut that whole thing short, the universe is out of thermal equilibrium now because on a sufficiently large scale, the notion of equilibrium is meaningless because equilibrium is defined with respect to a given Hamiltonian with e to the minus theta h. Okay. And if the laws themselves evolve in time, then any equilibrium is temporary, and overall the universe is far from equilibrium, and et cetera. So for me, this argument is important. Were Barber's move successful? In any case, one would be torn, but my reading of the situation at the present moment, if I may, is that the attempts to construct a quantum cosmology from which time is truly emergent in either of the two senses that we described have so far not succeeded. And therefore, that, together with precisely the motivation I've just been sketching, which means, if I can rub it in, that at the level of cosmology itself and the laws of nature themselves, we may very well face a situation analogous to the situation that Stu Kaufman describes in biology. That is, where properties relevant for elementary particle physics that are not anticipatable are emergent and novel in time. And because I don't see any other way to scientifically make progress on the question of why are the parameters of the standard model what they are, I think it's justified to examine these pretty crazy, pretty radical points of view, which is that, roughly speaking, that time is probably the only thing that is not emergent. Okay, now everybody really thinks I'm a fool, but that is the argument that I believe.
It relies on this non-algorithmic sort of evolution of the laws, right? But I think there's an interesting reason to believe that if you're talking about cosmology, you shouldn't expect an algorithmic evolution anyways. And that's just from Goethe's theorems. If you believe in a mathematical universe, then and you're talking about the whole universe, so you essentially have a theory of Alcock-like postulates and system of law, axiomatic law structure that should be consistent. But
see,
now it's going to be incomplete just because of Gödel's.
Most people who write on Gödel's theorem, including Gödel himself, think the argument cuts, think the fact of Gödel's theorem cuts the opposite way of the argument. Gödel himself took his two theorems, and one has to talk about both of them, the incompleteness or inconsistency and the impossibility, if it is complete, of proving within a given formal system completeness. He took it as strong evidence for, first of all, a Platonic view of mathematics, that is, for there being a timeless realm of mathematical truth that is explorable by us human beings, but never reducible to a single, to the implications of a single axiom system. And he took the fact, and he took Gödel's theorem to establish the existence of facts about mathematical reality which are not establishable in any axiomatic system, that is not establishable as a result of any running any algorithm, to be strong evidence for Platonism, that is for belief in a separate timeless existence of mathematical reality with mathematical objects, and then all infinite numbers of mathematical objects that you might imagine exist. And again, I take this as seriously to be a denial of Platonism. That is one of the projects that Richard Bertolunga was involved in, is there a non-Platonic account of what mathematics is consistent with the philosophical position that anything that is real or anything that is true or has a truth value is real or true or has a truth value only in a moment, which is one of a succession of moments. And now you see that what I really want to argue is that the deep structure of the world is that succession of moments in which, and that all things which are true or real or have truth values are bound within those moments. Let me say one last, we're verging on the time, let me say one last thing to tie up the discussions of the class, because there's a thread hanging, and I want to close up the thread. There is a standard argument which I gave earlier in the class against any form of presentism, including this one, and that the argument that it disagrees with the relativity of simultaneity, of special relativity, and general relativity. And I think I gave the argument before, so I'll just reference it, that if you believe that this is referring to a simultaneity of distant events, you know, in the moment means simultaneity of distant events, but given the relativity of simultaneity, if you believe that two events which I as an observer think are simultaneous are both real in this moment, some other observer will see this event as simultaneous with another event to the future of this one, but by the application of the statement, those are equally real, and therefore all the events, therefore you argue yourself to all the events in the space-time being equally real, and therefore you argue yourself to the block universe, that is, all the events in the whole history of the universe are equally real if any of them is real. And therefore you go from presentism plus the relativity of simultaneity to the opposite of presentism, which is the reality of every event in the block universe equally real. Let me just make the argument. I think that's an argument that philosophers, again, I don't remember, it's an argument that has been made in the philosophical literature. I think it's a logically correct argument. I think the only out is to deny the fundamental significance of the relativity of simultaneity. And I don't say that easily, but that's the conclusion that I come to. And that is why we spent some time discussing the emergence of space as opposed to the emergence of time, and the idea that there's originally in these approaches to quantum gravity we described last time and earlier, like with quantum gravity and matrix models, there is originally a absolute relativity, an absolute simultaneity, but there's no distant event, there's no locality. Every event is connected to every other event. I see your point. Only in an approximation does space emerge, does locality emerge, does the finite propagation speed emerge, and therefore does the relativity of simultaneity emerge only as an approximation. And I think that that's the only way out from the argument that otherwise would kill any form of presentism. So.
There is a different way out that was proposed in the philosophical literature without giving up absolute simultaneity or presentism, although many people say it's too high a price for presentism either way, which would be to say just because something you had to put into the argument was that me as an observer, I think, and I have my now, and I say something that is only space-like separated to me is then real as well because it's now too. And if one just gives up that and just says I'm presentist with respect to one point in space-time, not with respect to the stuff that's simultaneous to me, then I'm fine too, then I can remain a presentist. But you have to give up a lot, of course.
Yeah, you have to, yeah. You're now both presentist and theorist.
Yeah.
So I think that's fair, yeah.
Perhaps I misheard the argument, but it sounded like you're making the false assumption that simultaneity is transitive.
No, I you didn't mishear the argument. I didn't state it as carefully as I might have.
Transitive in the mathematical sense of.
So I assumed that being equally real was transitive. And if being equally real is observer dependent, then like simultaneity can be observer dependent. But then then that's another quote way out, but then you have a form of presentism in which what's real depends on your state of motion. So if you don't want what's real to depend on your state of motion, you want reality to be a yes or no thing. You want truth values to be yes or no things. And therefore, you want both being true and both being real to be transitive. If A is real, if A is real, if B is real, and if B is real and C is real, I'm not saying this right, but you know what I'm trying to say, then A is real and C is real. That is the form of the argument. But the only way to deny that is to either be observer dependent, to have a notion of reality that's observer dependent, which may be the quantum reference frames people would like to weigh in on, but I think we should be able to carry the discussion off at the level of classicalism. Anyway, We're sort of at 10 o'clock. Any comments out there, Western, as well? Okay. So thank you. I am very, by the way, I'm very interested, and it doesn't have to be right here now, in critiques of the general argument, which now I've sketched a lot more ins and outs and buts of it, but now I think I got to the outline of it. Just to repeat again, next time will be Harvey Brown, and you'll get to see the difference between real philosophers and the real knows history and philosophy. I think he's going to talk mostly about issues related to special relativity, but we'll see. And then unless you hear from me otherwise, we will skip the 16th because I have to be out of town. And then the next week we'll have Raphael Sorkin, and then we'll have one other class after that.
When do you want the papers?
That's an individual discussion with, so everybody who is doing a project should have a discussion with me about that. Okay, thanks very much.
Good course, Lee.